the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. I am thrilled to be back with a whole new respect for the strep virus, let me tell you. But after missing a few days, being ill, losing my voice, and just trying to fight that infection, I am glad to be back. And I'll tell you another thing. I'm very thankful in this 21st century to have the kind of antibiotics we have. No small thing to know that these bugs that killed off millions of persons in times past are now considered more of a nuisance than a tremendous threat to us. Folks, there are all kinds of things going on in the world today, but one of them, the New York Times, just demands our attention. Let me just tell you about it for a moment. It's one of those stories that just grips you. And in the case of this particular story, it's not just the words, it's also the visuals that went with it. It's in the fashion and style section of the New York Times yesterday. And it is one of those things that catches our attention precisely because it is so out of the ordinary and yet is presented by the newspapers, if it makes sense. I wrote about it today at albertmohler.com. This is how I started. Quote, it just saddens me to see so many of our strong butch women giving up their womanhood to be a man, end quote. I followed that line with this. Now, there's a statement your grandmother probably wouldn't understand. The whole issue of gender assignment surgery and transgender persons and all the rest is now rocketing onto pages of the New York Times, for instance, as one barometer of our culture. With the question, in terms of lesbians asking, are those who were lesbians and are now transgendered and turn themselves from women to men, are they joining the other side? Are they joining the enemy? And this newspaper article goes into such things of moral consequence as the Michigan Women's, that's M-O-M-Y-N apostrophe S, music festival, having to put in its advertising that it is open to, quote, women born as women, living as women, end quote. Folks, a story like this tells us that we are living in a time of grave, that's G-R-A-V-E, not just great, but grave moral confusion. When we are so confused over gender that you have a lesbian music festival having to limit itself to women born as women, living as women. And by the way, when we talk about this, I'm going to read to you from the website of the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which indicates that if you are a woman, born as a woman, living as a woman, who happens also to have children, one of them being a little boy, age 10 or younger, if you bring him, he has to be segregated in a boys' camp where he's kept away so that no one with an XY chromosome will infect the larger festival. Welcome to America in 2006. We're going to be talking about what this says about the culture. We're going to be talking about the issue of gender. And the bizarre stuff in this news article is not really peripheral, but it's going to serve more as a catalyst for us to look at the deeper issues at stake. Stay tuned. And if you want to go ahead and look at that newspaper article, go to albertmohler.com. That's Albert, M-O-H-L-E-R.com. Look at the article entitled, Want Proof That We Live in Strange Times? Go to the links and get ready to call. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Meanwhile, while we're talking about gender, USA Today has a debate on its editorial page concerning same-sex or single-sex education. This found in Thursday's paper. It's worthy of our comment today because this issue is coming up with schools opening today in many parts of the country. Today is the first day of school. According to press estimates, approximately 80% of American elementary, middle, and high school students are back in class as of today. You know, that just reminds us that summer seems to be getting shorter all the time. But nonetheless, with kids going back to school, there are debates anew about educating kids. And the fact is that boys are falling behind. That's not just an anecdotal statement. It's not just an intuitive statement. It's backed up with solid research. Boys are just not doing as well at school as girls are. And there are all kinds of reasons that are put forward for this. But the bottom line of it is, I think, again, the XY chromosome. Boys are not meant just by their very constitution and by their personality. In fact, I'm going to go ahead and say the way God made them. They weren't made primarily to sit still in a chair and listen. That's just not what they were made for. And the uniqueness of boys is something that really becomes a liability in the educational context, where girls actually are far better at doing those things, sitting still and listening. And so what you have are boys getting out of the mainstream. They're getting further and further behind. And with the denial of differences between the boys and the girls, you know, and with the ideology of feminism saying that it's girls that need more pampering and more concern and more money and more emphasis and all the rest, the boys fall further behind. It's interesting when you look at the arguments. The pro-single-sex education argument was made by USA Today. Now, I find that very interesting in and of itself. In other words, the paper itself, hardly conservative, said reality is that some of these single-sex education programs really do work. Reading from the editorial, they said a growing body of research shows that boys and girls learn differently. Boys in particular suffer from a one-size-fits-all approach, and as students reach middle school, they are increasingly distracted by members of the opposite sex. And apparently, academically, that hurts boys more than girls. But the opposing view comes from Emily Martin and Katie Schwartzman. Ms. Martin is with the ACLU Women's Rights Project, and Katie Schwartzman is a staff attorney of the ACLU of Louisiana. This is what they said. In addition to being unlawful, that is, single-sex programs, the rationale behind these programs is bad for kids. Advocates of sex-segregated schools offer pseudo-scientific workshops where educators learn about alleged brain differences between boys and girls. Now, I just love this. You talk about pseudoscience. Alleged brain differences between boys and girls? Let's just talk facts here. They are different. That's not pseudoscience. That's science. And by the way, it's well-accepted science. It's all over the place, both in terms of the academic literature and the popular literature. Says, quote, although these ideas are hyped as new discoveries about brain differences, they are in fact only dressed-up versions of old stereotypes. Well, they're dressed-up versions of just old reality. You know, a little reality therapy would help here. Goes on, and again, Ms. Martin and Ms. Schwartzman say, the most reliable evidence available shows that proven approaches to educational reform, such as smaller classes, teachers with decent salaries, and parental involvement, make more sense than separating boys and girls based on outmoded stereotypes. End quote. In other words, we're going to avoid the issue. We're going to deny the question. We're not even going to dignify the question. We're simply going to say, we need smaller classes. You know, we need more money. That's going to be the answer. There's no basic differences between boys and girls. Let me go back to what one woman said to me when we discussed this issue recently on the air. She came back and she said, who could possibly write that argument who has had, as a mother, a child of both genders, of both sexes? Pretty much settles the issue. Speaking of going back to school, kids are going back to school, and it's an ecological crisis, according to the Seattle Times. According to the Times, not only are kids going back to schools, but kids who take lunches in disposable bags or containers generate 45 to 90 pounds of garbage each year. That's almost 19,000 pounds of lunch waste for one average-size elementary school. The Seattle Times thinks this is an ecological crisis. All these kids taking their lunches to school and throwing things away in baggies and paper bags. And so it suggests instead going to green, ecologically friendly stores and buying such things as the laptop lunch bento box, which has a reusable polypropylene plastic food container, plus an ice pack and stainless steel fork and spoon, which your child can use and then bring back home to be cleaned. All I can tell you is, again, anyone who's had an elementary age boy knows you do not want that coming back home. You do not want whatever the debris is left over coming back home. It will come back alive, ladies and gentlemen. That would be the new ecological crisis. Speaking of kids taking things to schools, last week I wrote a great deal about how technology is changing this. And in a blog entry published at albertmuller.com in recent days, I talked about how some of these who are watching the kind of technology that kids take to school, cell phones now, elementary school students taking custom-designed little kid cell phones, flash drives, and even laptop computers to school. Some of these are saying that kids are, quote, being grown up fast in terms of technology. I'm really asking the question as to whether we want to grow them up fast in terms of this technology. Now, again, USA Today is out with a story suggesting that these kids are taking all kinds of technology. And not only are we talking about elementary school kids here, but colleges are having to adapt to tech-savvy new students who expect in their 24/7 digital lifestyle and all the rest to have endless and free and unrestricted access to all forms of digital technology, the internet, and all the rest. And not only that, they too, these college students, boys and girls, young men and young women, are finding it difficult to watch a teacher teach a class because their minds have been so molded by these new digital educational technologies that they're looking for motion pictures, 3D experience, digital sound, and all the rest. You know, folks, if you think that applies only to the educational environment, just consider the predicament of the preacher on Sunday morning who gets up to preach, and many in the congregation are just not used to listening to anyone talk for any duration of time without, background soundtrack, digital amplification, nice moving visuals, and all the rest. Now that's a challenge to think about. We'll be back to talk about what the confusion over gender really says about us. This is the Albert Mohler Program. You know, there are all kinds of digital instruments out there. One thing I would like is kind of the shock meter. It'd be great to have some kind of meter that really reflected what people are thinking in terms of their shockability when they see something. Because I don't think the New York Times, at least the editor of the fashion and style section on Sunday, really intended to shock people. At least the way the story is written, it doesn't appear to be self-consciously written as if it is to shock the reading audience. But I think it will. Now, that may tell you a whole lot about the New York Times. I think that probably is undoubtedly true. It may tell you a whole lot about the people who read the New York Times on a daily basis in that metropolitan area. But I think it also says something deeper about our culture. You see, the story is really about what happens in terms of the feminist and lesbian worldview when a woman, that is a person born as a woman, decides to have a sex change operation and becomes a man or presents herself as a man, are they then the enemy going over to the other side? This has become a storyline in the lesbian soap opera on cable television known as the L Word, where one character named Maura, who decides to become Max, finds this response from one of her lesbian friends: "It just saddens me to see so many of our strong butch women giving up their womanhood to be a man," end quote. Now, when I quoted that in my article, again, I said, now there's a statement your grandmother probably wouldn't, or for that matter, couldn't understand. We're talking about a whole new moral conversation we're having in America today. And a part of this is simply because if you just go backward in time, there is no such category as a transgendered person, maybe a transvestite, but this is a part of the modern, or better stated, the postmodern theory of a very plastic and liquid sexuality. And that's where the elites in this culture simply decided that gender is no longer a matter of biology. It's no longer a matter of how you are made. It's a matter of how you feel and how you feel at any given time. And now you have the interesting intersection, and here's really the point of our discussion today, the interesting intersection between the ideology of feminism and this ideology of absolute personal autonomy that says you have the right to be whoever you want to be. Let me read to you from the article in the New York Times yesterday. And now remember the statement that I just read you, quote, "The sentiment was a tamer version of what many other women wrote on lesbian blogs and websites in the weeks after the episode was broadcast last spring. Many called for the Max character to be killed off next season. One suggested killing him by, quote, testosterone overdose. The reaction to the fictional character captured the bitter tension that can exist over gender reassignment. Among lesbians, the group from which most transgendered men emerge," let me just put a little period there. That's something that maybe a lot of people wonder about. Now, this is the New York Times writing here saying that the group from which most transgendered men emerge are lesbians. That is the group that produces these persons who undergo the transition surgery from woman to man. Back to the article, "The increasing number of women who are choosing to pursue life as a man can provoke a deep resentment and almost existential anxiety, raising questions of gender loyalty and political identity, as well as debates about who is and who isn't and who never was a real woman." Now, again, let's just think about this. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation. We need to calmly and biblically, as Christians, think, what are we talking about here? How do we engage a sentence from America's certainly leading newspaper when it talks about debates about who is and who isn't and who never was a real woman? This is entirely new terrain. This is, however, the kind of terrain that that your kids are going to encounter when they go to the university. This is the kind of issue that is now being debated not only in academia, but now also in the media. It's the kind of issue that is going to become one of the flashpoints which may allow some persons to understand the depth of our current confusion. That's the big issue. How confused as a culture do you have to be to seriously ask the question, who is and who isn't and who never was a real woman? Or for that matter, who is and who isn't and who never was a real man? With the issue here being what are presented as surgical options. Again, most people just don't realize that the ideology behind the whole transgendered movement is that we internally, as autonomous human beings, have the right to decide what gender we are. The physical limitations with which we were born, most of us, the vast majority of us being born as either clearly male or clearly female, that seemed to be merely a physical construct that that may either correspond with who we know ourselves to be or not correspond with who we know ourselves to be. And the ideology here is that if you feel that your physical construct and your social construct does not fit who you are inside, then you have not only the right, but frankly, the obligation to change your social construct, that is the way you present yourself in public, and even your physical construct through gender reassignment surgery in order to be who you want to be. Now, another interesting thing going on here is we should footnote the fact that many of these persons evidently also change their mind. As a matter of fact, the first prison inmate in Great Britain to have received one of these operations in recent years and did so at the taxpayer expense of Great Britain now wants to have it all changed back. So evidently, it's not only who this person thinks he or she is at any given time, but what they may think in the future as well. Back to the New York Times, the reporter says the conflict has raged at some women's colleges and has been explored in academic articles, in magazines for lesbians, and in alternative publications, with some oversimplifying the issue for effect, such as the question, is lesbianism dead? Now, let me just tell you, at a couple of the leading women's colleges, and these are the very liberal women's-only colleges up in the Northeast, this has become a real issue. In other words, what about a boy who has undergone a sex change operation to become a girl, a young man who's undergone the surgery to become a young woman? Can he be admitted as a woman at these colleges? Increasingly, the women are saying no. So here you have feminism and the new sexual revolutionaries who had been absolute allies in the culture war now finding themselves at odds, with one saying, look, the individual has the right to say he is or she is whatever he or she wants to be, and gender assignment surgery simply kind of confirms that point. And others saying, no, this is a school only for women who always have and always will be women, women born as women who are still living as women. Folks are living in very interesting times. I mentioned this Michigan Women's Music Festival. That's M-O-M-Y-N apostrophe S. Remember that that is the effort by some very hardline ideological feminists to remove the letters or the word men with the letter E from the word women so that there is no taint whatsoever of having any association with men. But, you know, if you're having this women's festival, evidently you have to decide who can come and who can't. And they limit this to, quote, women born as women and living as women. But what I found really interesting on the website for this music festival is the fact that many of these women need child care, and they bring their kids. And if you do bring a boy, let's say you are a lesbian, and, of course, here you have to be a woman born as a woman, living as a woman, and you are the mom of the little boy, you can bring him, but he's going to have to go to camp. So that the little boys don't contaminate the rest of the festival, where it's women only, born as women, living as women. Folks, this is the time for us to discuss what this tells us about our culture. And it's also the time for us to discuss how do we respond to this in a way that is genuinely Christian, genuinely redemptive, but also genuinely truthful. You know, how do we engage in conversation with a person who is very much involved in either the sex change or the controversy or whatever is in process? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
My point in raising this whole article and the issues that emerge from it is because I think what we see here is something of the emerging worldview of the age. And that's what's genuinely troubling. It's not only troubling just from a moral standpoint. It's troubling from a personal standpoint, from a Great Commission standpoint. How do we speak of Christ and of God's purposes for our lives as men and women to persons whose raging debate is whether a women's lesbian festival should accept lesbians who undergo sex change operations to become men? You know, have they gone over to the enemy? This is a very, very twisted world. And yet the fact that it makes the style section of the New York Times tells us this isn't isolated. And one of the purposes of my raising this issue today is because I know many of us and many in this listening audience would never come in contact with this kind of question were it not for the fact that we're talking about it here today. But ladies and gentlemen, your children will. And quickly, when they go to the university, where these issues are being very much debated, when they enter the public world, when they get to the legislature, or when they get to, frankly, just to reading the New York Times, they're going to confront this kind of question. This is where all of us need to be sure we are thinking Christianly. That means compassionate truth-telling. You know, my first response in terms of my heart when I read this was a sense of brokenheartedness over the fact that here are so many persons whose urgent questions reveal such a deep sense of distance from what I believe God made them to be. And not only that, from where I wholeheartedly and genuinely and sincerely believe they would find true happiness. That to me is a sad, sad thing. And it ought to be a humbling thing for all of us. You know, there but by the grace of God go we. When we're talking about confused people, let's remember on this program, we're talking about people who are confused, yes. But it's no real virtue for us that we are not equally confused. This is by the grace and mercy of God that we have been given the grace of God's revelation in the Holy Scripture to know how we are to think about these things. If we did not have that direction, why would we not be as confused as anyone else? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa, where Lisa's on the line, listening on KFFF. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I really think that in order to engage with these women, we really have to kind of take on kind of the same role that Christ did. He came to this earth and he dealt with people that none of us would deal with, criminals and prostitutes, and he still loved them. He didn't agree with them. He rebuked them, but he still loved them. And he sat down and he ate with them, and he, you know, invited them to be around him, even though he was so far from ever sinning.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
No, I'm agreeing with you. So what would you have us to do, Lisa? I think you're a very profitable line here. Just, you know, what would you have us to do, you think?
Just, I don't know. I find that the protesting and all this stuff that a lot of radical Christians do, it doesn't change anybody's mind. These people, these women, and anybody who's in their situation where they're lost, already have a mindset of what Christians are like, and it's this radical Christians who protest and say, you're going to hell. And while that may be true, telling them that they're going to hell, scaring them to Christ, is not the way that Christ won people for him when he was on earth.
Yeah, Lisa, I appreciate your call. Very interesting point. And I think you have a very good point to make about the compassionate part of compassionate truth-telling. I will tell you, I think there's a limitation, however, on just how short of what you're talking about there we can be. For instance, remember that Jesus did, for instance, say, fear not the one who can destroy the body, but fear the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell. In other words, when you talk about scaring people, I mean, Jesus himself was very blunt about the just consequences of the wrath of God poured out upon our sin. I understand what you're saying. I think that was a very good point. And hopefully your call will be a catalyst for others as well. The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I think one of the most difficult things about this is that many persons now say, I won't talk to you unless you will now accept me just as I am. And I think that is one of the greatest evangelistic and missiological issues, challenges that we really face today. In other words, how do we talk to people engaged in the very kind of ideas and lifestyles that we've just been talking about here, who say, I can't talk with you unless you accept me just as I am? You know, that's the one thing. What does accept mean there? We can't just leave it at that. The phone number 877-893-8255. I'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. If you haven't seen the New York Times story, let me just warn you, it's pretty explicit, and I'm not really recommending it except as a touchstone. And it may be that this is the kind of article that would really prompt some interesting discussion with teenage children or young adult children. You know, and how do we relate to people like this? Because I guarantee you they're going to meet people like this. According to the same news story, there are approximately, and these are rough estimates, but approximately 13,000 men who have undergone surgery to become women, and approximately 5,000 women who have undergone surgery to become men. They tend to be inordinately localized in metropolitan areas, especially on the two coasts, but they're really spread all over America. And an exponentially larger number of persons are presenting themselves, having been born a man, presenting themselves as a woman, or being born as a girl, presenting themselves as male in ways that do not involve gender reassignment surgery. Now, I can just promise you that if your kid is going to college, your child is going to school, they're going to be confronting some of these questions, and they're going to be confronting them in interesting ways. I mean, earlier this year on this program, I dealt from California with what happens when parents are faced with elementary school-aged children who go to class on Monday, and it's now Mrs. Jones, where it had been Mr. Jones on Friday. In other words, what happens when you've got a second grader who's now facing this whole sex reassignment issue because his teacher just decided to change gender assignment? You know, what happens in terms of marriage law? That is a raging issue in terms of legal debate. Let's say that here's a woman who undergoes sex reassignment surgery to become a man. Can she now marry another woman legally, even in a state that does not recognize same-sex marriage? And evidently there, that's an unsettled question in some states. This particular news story says that it has been successful in others. But this whole debate between the feminists, and especially the lesbians, and those who undergo this sex reassignment surgery is fascinating, because what it reveals is that in this postmodern worldview, relativism only goes so far. And I think that's what's really interesting, because moral relativism and values relativism obviously has limits. And one of the limits that is faced in this article is feminists who believe that gender is a social construct are only willing to take that argument so far. I think that right there is worthy of an entire article. In fact, that might be worthy of a book-length analysis. These feminists have been arguing that gender, that is, sex, whether male or female, is only a social construct. It's nothing more. It's not basically rooted in biology. It's not rooted in nature. It is rooted simply as a social construct. That's all it is. But evidently, that has its limits. When you start putting up signs that say, this is open only to women born as women, living as women, you are way past just a social construct here. And folks, I think that's just a reminder to us as Christians that this whole postmodern worldview has inherent limitations. We need to remember that. We need to remember that every worldview eventually is going to have to face the test of consistency. And no one can be an absolute relativist. No one can hold that all truth is really only socially constructed. Eventually, everyone has to deal with the fact that 2 + 2 really does equal 4. And North really is an objective reality. And the law of gravity doesn't bend to anyone's theory of relativity. I mean, these things are just very, very important. You can say that language is entirely mutable. You can make the argument that morality, you know, in different cultures has been expressed in different ways. But eventually, you're going to come down to some kind of absolute. You know, the old saying is that even anarchist groups have leaders. And when you get that pun, you'll understand what's going on. In other words, there's something in human nature that cries out for leadership. Even in groups against leadership, there's a leader. And the same thing is true when you have this kind of moral relativism. It reaches its obvious and logical conclusion, which is some kind of absolute. And these feminists, in this case lesbians, have found an absolute. The only women that they'll accept as women are those that are born as women and living as women. Well, all right then, it's not just about social construction, is it? It's not just about social constructs of sexuality. It's about the fact that there really are differences between men and women, boys and girls. If there were not inherent differences, you wouldn't have to, for instance, at the Michigan Women's Music Festival, put all the little boys in a camp where they're kept separate so that the women's area is not contaminated. Folks, we're living in interesting times, and one of the responsibilities, key responsibilities of Christians in an opportunity like this, is to think about not only how do we respond to this politically and culturally, because they are political and cultural questions. They're legal questions. These issues are going to be adjudicated in the courts. But, you know, I guarantee you these issues are going to be all over the place. What do you do, for instance, with Title IX? What if you're a university administrator? What do you do with Title IX? Sports, how do you count persons who were born boys but now are girls? How do you count that in your equation and in your federal reports? You know, in terms of non-discrimination law, how in the world do you handle these things? You know that one of the issues being seriously debated, and I mean this, seriously debated in some universities, is whether it's discriminatory to have men and women's bathrooms. You know, the logic of this is going to be played out in the legislatures, in the bureaucracies, in the policymaking organizations, in the courts, and we have to be engaged in that. There's no way out of it. We can't act like we can just be AWOL from this larger cultural discussion. Christians have a responsibility to be engaged with that. But our far greater responsibility is a gospel responsibility. How do we speak lovingly and yet truthfully, compassionately and yet honestly, to persons who are involved in lifestyles and in worldviews and ideologies and value systems that are so incredibly different than our own? I think, honestly, this is going to be one of the great challenges for the Christian church in the 21st century. How do we speak and how do we engage with groups that are just so distant from us in terms of worldview? How do we recognize our changed position in America as believing evangelical Christians, as what we hope to be scripturally minded Christians? How do we understand our changed position when the style section, the fashion pages of the New York Times, treat this as if it's just a normal development in the evolution of our culture? I think that is a huge question, and it's one of the questions to which we will return time and time again on this program. I can tell you, as a minister, as a pastor, as a seminary president, as a college president, as a father, this is the kind of question that really, really engages my mind and heart, not just because I find it interesting, but because I find it desperately urgent. Folks, we are called to be salt and light. Certainly there's a political and a cultural application of that, but far more important, there's a gospel application of that. How are we living in our families? How are we operating in our marriages? How are we operating as Christian men and Christian women in a way that shows the glory of God in the midst of such confusion? We'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. Coast to Coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program. Well, time passes like an ever-rolling stream, the song says, taking all its sons away. And one of those sons, Joe Rosenthal, was taken away. He was the photographer who was at Iwo Jima on February 23, 1945, who took the now famous photograph of the four Marines raising the United States flag. You know, oddly enough, I was just reading Martin Gilbert's History of the 20th Century in recent days, where he deals with this incident. It's one of the most horrible incidents of World War II. It's some of the most difficult fighting. The Japanese soldier had been trained in the ideology of Bushido so that he would not surrender. And because of that, the warfare was simply horrible And by the way, two of the four Marines who are pictured raising this flag died within 24 hours of the event taken on February 23, 1945. It was the costliest fight in Marine Corps history. The photograph depicts Ira Hayes, Franklin Soucy, John Bradley, Harlan Block, Michael Strank, and Rene Gagnon. And so, by the way, there are about six who were there, but of them, two died just in fighting in hours thereafter. You know, one of the interesting things about this is the reminder that we sit today in the year 2006 debating issues, just today, out of a news story in the New York Times, discussing the events of the day. And we often forget just what was necessary in times past that we could even today be having this conversation. And so today, just with the passing of Joe Rosenthal and of those who were involved in the raising of this flag in different times, and with the death of about 7,000 veterans of World War II every single week, it's a reminder to us of the indebtedness we have to previous generations. Not just those who were soldiers in World War II, but previous generations who sacrificed so much and dedicated themselves to such a degree that we are able to have this conversation today. You know, the sense of indebtedness and gratitude is something that's largely missing from our cultural life. We live as if the present is all that really matters, and we live as if everything that we have is that which we deserve. I opened the program today mentioning that even as I have been struck and stricken with an illness and an infection in last week that took me off the air, took my voice away, and, you know, frankly, was just one of those things that catches you by surprise and makes you sicker than you remember being last. This is just one of those things that reminds us that I'm very grateful for those who, for instance, have been working for years on antibiotics, for those who even now are working on vaccines for things like the avian flu. Folks, we live under an umbrella of gratitude that often is just invisible to us. And, of course, our ultimate gratitude is to our Creator God, who's given us minds and voices with which to see and speak and think, in order that we can join together, even on this program, for intelligent Christian conversation. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about whether or not our lives are our own. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.